everyone. Welcome back to Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. Before we jump into today's episode, happy Juneteenth. If you're unfamiliar, this holiday celebrates the day that the last enslaved people in the U.S. were freed on June 19, 1865. It's not a federal or bank holiday, but for some reason, America still celebrates a white man who terrorized the people he encountered on an island he discovered. I would say it's ironic, but it's actually systemic racism at the core of American society. In light of that, today's episode examines misinformation. What is it? And why do the words fake and news always seem to be placed together? Then, as always, we'll discuss this week's most pressing headlines, and then we'll close out the show with my interview with Sapna Suresh, a researcher at Northwestern University studying media psychology, persuasion, and misinformation. If you haven't already, grab your summer drink of choice. Mine's obviously a margarita, and let's dive in. This week, we're talking about misinformation. I feel like lately we hear about misinformation all the time, but I haven't really taken the time to stop and ask myself, what exactly is misinformation? Well, simply put, misinformation is false or inaccurate information, often deliberately used to deceive. I know, it didn't take a Harvard graduate to deduce the definition of that term, but even still, you're probably used to hearing its more popular synonym of fake news, the phrase that was, of course, made famous by Trump. Because apparently, misinformation contained too many syllables that could be stored in his vocab bank. I digress. While it may be easy to define the concepts of misinformation and fake news, it has proven very difficult to discern what is misinformation and what is not, as Russia proved during our last election cycle. Plus, if you've been on Facebook in the last half decade, you have no doubt seen members of your own family spread and parrot talking points expressed from, quote, fake news. So, the questions I have to ask myself are, what are the telltale signs of false information? And how can I verify the information I'm taking in is valid? How can I tell the difference between the two? And how is it that people continuously fall for misinformation? And how can I help them realize this without shutting them down? Kind of a tall order. However, if we're talking in Starbucks terminology, then it's really a small order. And this should be easy. Let's start with some examples of fake news, since these are the things I feel most people come across in their day-to-day routines. Essentially, fake news can be boiled down into three main categories: clickbait, sponsored content, and fabricated journalism. Clickbait is a story, often sensational or featuring a sensational headline, geared towards getting clicks to generate ad revenue. Everyone knows what clickbait is. BuzzFeed built a company on it. 10 reasons Bigfoot definitely exists. Or 12 ways to lose fat without going to the gym. Because of their nature of generating ad revenue through clicks, they don't care about the validity of the content they put out, simply that it is put out, and that the headline is interesting enough to get people to click on it. Plain and simple. Next is sponsored content. And I'm not talking about like the Nike ads or anything that you see on the side banners of Facebook. Sponsored content is typically a story that is made to appear as independent journalism, when in fact it is public relations or advertising. This is where things start to get a little tricky. This is typically where you'll see a human peace story in the news that looks like it's promoting the story of a person, when really it's using that person to promote the story of the brand. A website called LibGuides gives an excellent example of a story about how a company's project will help the lives of locals in the city. Also, before you get ahead of yourself, LibGuides is not a website of guides on how to be liberal. In this case, lib is short for library, so don't come at me. After sponsored content, there is the easier to understand fabricated journalism, which, simply put, are news stories that are just made up, sometimes including made-up quotes and sources. The Wire season 5, anyone? But seriously, that one's pretty easy to comprehend. Fabricated journalism is a literal synonym for fake news. Now you know what is fake news. So let's hear some examples of what is not fake news. Things like satire. Satire is exaggerated dramatic irony used to make fun of issues. However, occasionally I will see someone post a link to an Onion article and exclaim outrage at the clearly satirical premise. Don't be that person. Don't accidentally eat the Onion. Another example of what is not fake news is when journalists make honest reporting mistakes, because, like, they're human. Mistakes will be made. Although, once called out on these mistakes, any organization with integrity will issue a correction and an apology for such misreporting. I would maybe consider it a red flag if someone is unwilling to admit a mistake. Like, hypothetically, if for some reason someone were to accidentally misspell, the word coffee via text, but refuse to admit it, that might be a red flag and or the source of fake news. My last, my probably favorite example of what isn't fake news is simply journalism you don't like. Just because you don't like what you're hearing doesn't mean it's not true. I can't walk outside in the middle of winter and call it fake weather just because I want Florida weather year-round here in Chicago. It just is what it is. On the other hand, alternative facts also aren't a thing. Because if an alternative fact is true, then it's just a fact. There's nothing alternative about it. If you're pointing out a fact from a different point of view, it's less of an alternative fact as opposed to a fact also. Like, facts are facts. I really don't know what else to say to that. Okay, now we understand the difference between what is fake news or misinformation and what isn't. But it has been a hashtag trending term for like a quinquennial now, so if people are so hyper aware of it, then why do people keep falling for it? Well, according to libguides.com, there are several systemic reasons. The first is a growing decline in the trust of the media and the government, which is really understandable. There have been studies showing how people respond more attentively to negative stories. So if a news organization is trying to remain competitive, then they're gonna have to focus on reporting negative stories. These stories may only be happening every now and again and thousands of miles away from what your reality is, but if it's all we see in the media, it's easy to think that this is happening all the time. With that double-edged blade, the media has also exposed so much of the corruption rampant in our government. It only took Nixon being in the White House for everything to become something gate. I mean, we even had a deflate gate over whether someone was deflating air out of footballs. Nonetheless, the distrust in these two institutions, these two pillars that we built our country on, just lay the groundwork for people to begin to be skeptical. And when people are skeptical, they're going to fall back on their beliefs as their baseline for truth. Because the only person I can trust is myself. And that only compounds when you think of how the internet has exploded and allowed us to stay embedded in our own echo chambers. And misinformation is tailored to appeal to our emotions. Our lizard brains are going to jump right past reasoning once our core beliefs are triggered. It took me a long time to figure out that trying to argue a point with logic will not help me convince someone to change their minds. In fact, I still struggle with that when debating subjects with people. Then, you have to think about how people can now create and put out their own content without any of the burdens of having to fact-check their statements, like professional journalism does. And not only is it easy to make, but it's also easy to make it look professional, with the help of websites like Wix. Wix, the only website builder that allows you to build top-notch, professional-looking websites for a fraction of the price. Sign up now with promo code. I'm just kidding, we aren't sponsored by Wix. But we're putting it out there that we aren't opposed to it. Seriously though, it is super easy to make something look professional nowadays, and to share an article presenting misinformation just because it looks professional. It becomes only easier to make that mistake when you take into account that all of our content is essentially aggregated into a single news feed, just mixing it in with family and friends' updates and opinions. Combine that with technology tailoring to our lower attention spans and infinite amounts of internet bots bombarding our eyes with fake stories left and right, it's really hard to avoid fake news at all. Like I said earlier, one common confusion is that misinformation is simply news I don't like or agree with. Although this could be a compelling argument for, I don't know, the oversized blood orange in the White House, that is not what misinformation is. That is what we call a bias. I'm gonna pray we all know what a bias is, but if you were dropped on your head as a baby, a bias is a prejudice in favor of or against one thing, person, or group compared with another, usually in a way considered to be unfair. And whether we realize it or not, we all exhibit biases in one way or another. Biases are especially prevalent in the media. Every news site, no matter how respectable or reputable, exhibits biases in one form or another. It's critical to understand that media sites all have a specific audience they cater to. They write in a specific way or have a specific tone to better reach their intended audience. Media bias is one of the reasons there are so many different places to get news from, and why some people watch Fox and Friends and others listen to the NPR Politics podcast. One could even argue that Sit Still Look Opinionated is somewhat biased. And you're right, we don't like Trump, but at least we're upfront about it. Biases differ from misinformation in the sense that biases don't always include the whole picture when relaying a piece of news. While misinformation employs false facts and untrue statements, biases in the media aren't inherently good or bad, but they can lead to confusing headlines and misleading stories. That's why it's important to always cross-check and research the news and information you consume. Here at Sit Still Look Opinionated, we always encourage you to do your own research and to come to your own conclusions, and also why we include all of our sources in the show notes. In that same vein, here are some tips about how to discern if the news you consume is, in fact, misinformation. First off, recognize that biases exist in yourself, your news, and in your daily life, and be aware of this. Try to read news and information from a critical point of view rather than an emotional one. Question the way news stories are relayed. What language is being used? And are the news sites displaying stereotypes or polarizing opinions? If you do run into any of these, dig deeper. Compare other stories with similar subject matters and find the differences. And above all else, think before you share. What are these articles really saying? Who are they supporting? And who are they oppressing? If you practice these tips, you'll be on your way to deciphering misinformation in no time. Furthermore, it's critical to understand misinformation because, like it or not, it's having a big moment in American society. When I look into my crystal ball to the future, I know this time will be categorized as Trump's fake news era, and let's hope it stays in the past. An overarching goal of this podcast is to give you all the tools to form opinions. And to do that, you need to be able to sift through the troves of information and misinformation that's out there. For more about the intersectionality of misinformation and American culture, stay tuned for my interview with Northwestern University researcher Sapna Suresh. Up next, this week's headlines. Warnings from public health officials. This weekend, President Trump will hold a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Apparently, Trump and his protesters forgot that COVID-19 is still running rampant. But according to Trump, the virus is on schedule to disappear any day now, just like my faith in this country's leaders. In fact, earlier this week, Trump publicly stated that the number of coronavirus cases would drop if we just stopped testing for it. Yes, and we wouldn't have Trump as our president if people just stopped voting. But for now, it looks like we're stuck with the plague, so... Continuing with the coronavirus, Florida, Texas, and Arizona have each reported about 2,000 new cases after reopening their states. I would say this is the second wave that Fauci kept talking about, except none of those states ever really shut down to begin with, so I guess this is just karma. In that same vein, the World Health Organization halted trials of the supposed COVID cure, hydroxychloroquine. Clinical analysis revealed the drug has shown to do more harm than good. Except for Trump, this comes as a shock to no one. This week, the Supreme Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act protects gay, lesbian, and transgender people in the workplace. The law was originally passed in 1964, and it only took 56 years for it to federally apply to the LGBTQIA+ community. I guess conservatives are right. Progress is incremental. Eye roll. This week also revealed more tragedy and injustice in communities across the country. We mourn the losses of Toyin Salu, Rayshard Brooks, Robert Fuller, and Malcolm Harsh. Don't forget their names. Keep pushing for change. Up next, my interview with researcher at Northwestern University, Sapna Suresh. So, for today's interview, we have Sapna Suresh. She is a researcher at Northwestern University, and she's studying media psychology, persuasion, and misinformation. and she is interested in understanding the modern communication environment. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Claire. It's great to be here.
Great. So to get us started for today's interview, could you just tell me a little bit about your background and how you decided you wanted to study communication?
Sure. And thanks for having me, Claire. So essentially, in undergrad, I took a behavioral economics class and I really enjoyed it. And that was kind of my first taste to the world of communications and framing research. And I was curious to learn more about it. And another project I was involved in was a policy competition where we were trying to motivate people who were affected by this one natural disaster to change their behavior in a way that would ultimately benefit them, but kind of having to grapple with personal choices that they didn't want to make or that they wanted to make. So we kind of had to frame a policy solution in a way that was easily digestible and appealing at the same time to them. And after being successful in that competition and getting really good feedback from the people who were on the receiving end, essentially the people affected by the policy, I was interested in potentially looking at policy as a field of employment. And I found out that, you know, graduate degrees in that field usually required a few years of work beforehand. And so I investigated maybe other kinds of research opportunities that existed. And I found out that there's this whole body of academia that focuses on, you know, framing research and misinformation and media. And I think that was something that was just really appealing to me after reading through some of the studies that they were publishing. And I guess I kind of took a blind leap of faith and said, I'll apply to this PhD program. And I got in and here I am now.
That's amazing. That's such a cool story. So now that you're in your PhD program, what does it look like? What's your research entailing?
Yeah, so I basically do about 3 classes a quarter and then spend maybe 8 to 10 hours a week doing research. And my research broadly falls within the realm of media psychology and social influence. So I've done projects on a couple different things, like one that looks at the role of emotions in motivating pro-environmental behaviors, another that looked at the efficacy of this tailored narrative film in encouraging women who have low adoption rates of long-acting reversible contraceptives to actually learn about what those products are and to go get them, to boost their self-efficacy to go get them. And a really interesting project I'm working on this upcoming summer is going to look at the relationship between the content in misinformation articles and why that necessarily makes them go viral, because there was a really interesting study published in this seminal journal called Science that showed that, you know, from 2007 to 2016, false news diffused far more broadly and quickly and deeply than truthful news in like pretty much every sphere of information. So I want to kind of unpack that and see what is it content-wise within the fake news that inherently makes it more viral, because there's already a lot of research that looks at why people would share information that's fake, but not necessarily what maybe is so appealing about that content.
So that's super interesting. That's really, really, I think, going to be meaningful. So basically, it's looking at not why people share, but like what the title of the, like why the news gets shared. Is that what you're saying? Sorry, could you explain it one more time?
Yeah, sure, definitely. So you got it right. Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, people share information because, you know, we know because it's something that's really speaks to them in an emotional way, like they feel really emotionally moved by it, or they think that it coheres with what they already believe. So they want to share that with their social networks as a way of socially signaling, you know, this is what I believe, and maybe this is how you should think too. But what I'm interested in is basically what about misinformation makes them super interesting to the person such that they want to share it and that they have these emotions and that they feel it coheres with their beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's not necessarily true or productive information.
Exactly. And my hypothesis is kind of that it follows this like story narrative format, and story narrative formats have been found to be super persuasive. And so that's sort of what I'm guessing, and we'll see if it is the truth.
Yeah, we'll have to circle back with you at the end of the summer to see what your research finds.
Yeah.
So we are living in this like super interesting time where a lot of things are changing and a lot of these movements are happening between COVID-19, the Black Lives Matter movement. Have you, from your perspective, seen a change in media just in the last few weeks, or does it tend to happen more over time?
I think it definitely has. I mean, over time, broadly, the fact that we have all these social media tools like Twitter, Facebook means that, you know, individual people can kind of set the agenda with regards to like what's being talked about and what's being discussed. If you think about like Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper, that was one person recording an interaction in a park and it went so viral. And if you think about it, like how would mass media in older days when people didn't have that sort of agency in putting that information out there, how would that have become such, you know, important news if people didn't have that agency? And I think that kind of is something that's changing the current movements and the current information environment as well, because I think when, you know, you go to these protests, yes, you see that the media is kind of the one, you know, like when I say media, I'm thinking TV and newspapers that are focusing on how violent protests might be. But if you look on Twitter, for example, you see that people are like, oh, the, you know, the news reporters are tending to focus on this one thing that they think will capture attention. But if you look, there's so many more protests. If you just look at the statistics, like there's so many more protests that are truly peaceful, where people are being respectful, where there isn't looting and pillaging. And I mean, people can have different opinions on that. It's just interesting to see how mainstream media sort of focuses on those things versus if you look at sort of user controlled media, you get a much different picture, or at least you get a broader image of what's really going on if you're not there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion about Twitter now labeling tweets as misleading? Is that going to be something that goes forward, like a practice for most social media, or do you think that Twitter is standing alone in that?
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting. My lab and I actually just recently published a paper on the role. It's a meta-analysis, which means it's sort of a synthesis of a large body of work that's already been published in the realm of corrections of misinformation and kind of investigating whether or not those are effective or not. And so, you know, Twitter's been under immense pressure to perhaps call out false information in some way, right? And what our study actually showed is that corrections to misinformation can be effective. Now, there are different factors that can make it more effective than not. And one of those is if it's fact-checked from someone within your own community. Now, Twitter labeling, we'll see. I guess, you know, you kind of have to wait and see if that's going to be effective. But I think from a moral point of view, they probably felt pressure both internally and maybe the decision makers themselves felt within themselves that they had to begin fact-checking information that was patently false that was coming from the president. But how effective that is at actually changing minds, you know, it clearly caused some backlash from the president himself. We'll kind of have to wait and see what the effects are over time.
Yeah. See if more tweets start coming out and more things start getting labeled as misleading, like kind of see what those repercussions are.
Yeah. See if it's something that Twitter kind of adopts as a broad policy, and also to see if just, you know, is it worth it? Is it worth the political risks? You know, Trump actually shot back at them by creating this legislation that was supposed to revoke their protections in terms of getting sued if people were to post inflammatory content on the platform. And, you know, that's a risk to them. That's a legal risk. That's something that could undermine the strength of the business. But maybe that is going to be worth it. Maybe more people are going to believe in Twitter. More people are going to use the platform. More people will turn to it, and that'll in turn create more advertising revenue for them. Or it could be all the opposite, and perhaps it's going to cause a significant blow, and then they're just going to walk back that effort. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, time will definitely tell about that. This might be backtracking a little bit, but you touched on misinformation, and I know that's part of your study. Can you speak a little bit about how misinformation happens, like why it even exists, and sort of the process of misinformation?
Sure. So misinformation is a super interesting topic, and I know it's top of everybody's mind. It has been since 2016. Mm-hmm. I think it exists for several reasons, you know, like I think the interesting distinction is it an unintentional or is it willful misinformation? So you know, some people post stuff that they haven't thoroughly fact-checked or vetted, or they share things that already exist, and it kind of has particular qualities to it that make it engaging, that make it clickbaity, and people share it, and then it goes viral. And that honestly could just be because, oh, I'm not diligently fact-checking every piece of information that I engage with, but this seems legit, and I believe it, so I'm going to share it. So that's kind of like an unfortunate byproduct of people not doing their homework. The other kind I feel like, which is a little bit more insidious, is willful misinformation. You know, people who have a political aim, people who just want to sow discord among the population or undermine faith in our systems, they will intentionally create these false narratives or these false stories that can have really significant implications. I'm sure you remember like Pizzagate, and I mean, obviously what happened with the election. Mm-hmm. I think that is what's a lot more dangerous, and being able to control it is quite hard because oftentimes it's really made, you know, these sort of like insidious ways in which they know that people will believe it, will buy into it, and will share it, and it can have some pretty deadly consequences. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that line between willful misinformation and people just not doing their homework, do you think that line ever blurs and people don't quite realize what's going on when they share things on Facebook or Twitter or wherever?
Yeah, I mean, I think some people might eventually delude, might be a harsh word, but delude themselves into thinking, like, if this thing that I shared was fake news, but it still furthered like my political aims, like I don't care. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of a threat to the fabric of our society, if I may be a little dramatic, but I think that it might be, just because I would hope that everybody cares about truth and like not submitting themselves to this whole notion of a post-truth world, like to at the end of the day be like, I said something wrong, even if it was something that maybe helped my candidate in the long run, it was wrong. But, you know, I would hope that that wasn't the case, but I'm sure there are people out there who don't mind that if they, you know, even if they see it and they think it might be fake, but they share it anyways, or they find out after the fact, perhaps it's just something that they're willing to live with.
So sometimes people don't necessarily dig deeper into what they're sharing. It just appears to reflect whatever thing they want to forward. And then they're like, oh, this is great, when it turns out it might actually have some like negative connotations to it.
Absolutely. Also the fact that there's so many satire sites out there now, and I've seen a crazy number of people like sharing or liking satire that they think actually reflects their own views, but is really making fun of their views, which is sort of a like funny byproduct of this whole misinformation phenomenon, I guess.
Yeah, I remember I was talking to, I can't remember who I was talking to, someone in an improv class, and I was like, oh yeah, like Huffington Post and The Onion, those are like based in satire. And they were like, what? And I was like, how did you not know that? I was like, really? Like, that's, I thought that was just, you know, actually, I might have been talking to Perry. Perry. Yeah.
Perry, no. Do not get your news from The Onion.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, The Onion's definitely not a credible source. If you're looking for satire, it is, but do you think satire and misinformation have a cross section at all, or do you think they have different purposes? I don't know if that's too deep of a question.
I mean, I think their cross-section is kind of what we just talked about. I think it is that sometimes people conflate the two because they don't have a good understanding of the source itself, or maybe they don't look at even who the source is, and they're like, this headline seems appealing, and they share it. They might not even click on the article. Like, some of these things, I feel like you can just open the article, read the first sentence, and you can tell it's satire. So I think sometimes it's just that. And I mean, I think I enjoy satire on the internet. I think it's kind of an interesting form of catharsis almost for me to read that and being like, there's so many painful things happening in the world, but like, why do people like watching SNL? Why do people like the jokes that like the late night news show host crack? I think it's kind of like a catharsis where you're like in this process with a person who's like almost socially sanctioned to like make fun of the pain that we're all experiencing, or like how frustrating and debilitating the situation might be. They're still there to kind of like put a spin on it, where you know they're making fun of the events, but at the same time, like, there seems to be this communal acknowledgement that this is still like kind of a crappy situation, or these are crappy times we're in. Mm-hmm. At least I would say that the tenor of what is being talked about in the last like 4 years is typically negative. So that's kind of how I'm interpreting that right now.
I really appreciate that response, because sometimes I feel like, oh, is there time for jokes right now? Especially like I'm a comedian, and to think that it's just sort of a way to, yeah, release and understand what's going on a little bit more. I think that's a great,
absolutely.
That's great. Yeah, that's sort of maybe more of a moral conversation than a media conversation, possibly.
Mm-hmm. But it also kind of goes to show,
go ahead.
I think it also kind of goes to show that, you know, we talk about how, or at least I mentioned earlier, how I think with regards to the Black Lives Matter protests, it's really great how I have access to, for example, Twitter, and I can find out about a lot of these activism efforts and these organizing efforts because I'm getting information from individual people and on a mass scale. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that's dangerous, because putting that power in the hands of people who want to do bad, I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's a moral question, but it's also a question of like, people now have faith in Twitter that they can learn from it. But now they might be willing to learn bad things, or they might be unwittingly learning bad things.
Mm-hmm. So there are sort of two sides of the same coin. It could be used for good or used for bad.
Right.
And speaking of, you know, people maybe unwillingly sharing things or reading things on the media, do you think it's ever possible to change someone's opinion on misinformation if they've received it, or that people's opinions do change?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And it's a tough question that a lot of people are trying to figure out how to deal with. You know, like that study that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. corrections to misinformation, especially within your social network, can be helpful. But, and I think a lot of that has to do with the implicit trust we put in people we know. And I mean, there are definitely ways to address misinformation. If something is said and there is convincing statistical evidence to counter that, okay, that makes sense. Now, if it's something just like a story that's been constructed or some sort of narrative, it's kind of harder to disprove those things. On a broader scale, changing opinions, I think it's difficult, especially in a hyper-polarized environment. Mm-hmm. One area of research I'm really interested in is a concept called moral reframing. And basically, it argues that, you know, since there's this big body of research that shows that there are fundamental differences in the moral foundations of conservatives and liberals, if we talk about unambiguously good things, you know, like addressing climate change, and even though, you know, it's sort of politicized as a leftist issue, if we were to talk about climate change using the conservative moral foundations as like the primary frame, that could be significantly more compelling. Now, it's worked in other contexts and largely in apolitical contexts, but I would be interested to see how this could be developed and brought further into the political topic domain, so that we can, you know, move the needle on pretty important things.
I didn't even know about that there's different ways in which they form thoughts and conversations. Is that basically getting at it?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure like implicitly, like it's there for you. Like, I'm sure you know it on some level. When you think about conservative stereotypes, I think you think about like fairness and preventing harm and justice. And these are really broad words, but those are kind of like the themes that it captures, versus, you know, on the liberal side, they care a lot about equity. And there's a, you know, these are broad terms, but I think that they can be effectively operationalized in messaging, in, you know, interpersonal discourse. Just if you like kind of deconstruct the messages that each side typically uses, you can find that they have kind of common core themes running through them that can be used sort of to help bridge these divides, to reduce you know, affective polarization, which is what we call just like dislike of the out party, mm-hmm. just talking in their language.
Mm-hmm. That totally makes sense. Like if you frame something in a way that will be easy for people to digest, they might understand it a little better.
Mm-hmm. And they might even just be more receptive to it because it's spoken in the language that they know, that they're familiar with, that they like.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I can even see that in other aspects of the world. Like if you put something in a way that people will, it'll draw people that it's meant to draw to. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's this concept in politics, which ironically I learned about from Scandal years ago, and I think it kind of has a pejorative connotation to it, called dog whistle politics, which is where messages will subliminally be targeting like a particular group who and supposed to be like especially effective for those people or especially meaningful to those people. I think that there's some sort of pejorative connotation to it, mm-hmm. and perhaps there's something worse in its history, but I think that the like larger concept of like using what means a lot to another person in order to have a more effective conversation with them, I think that is a powerful tool that I'm interested in exploring more, and I'm sure a lot of people are.
Yeah, I'm definitely, when I first started this podcast, I wanted to frame it in a way that would be easy for everyone to understand. And then I quickly learned that you do have to frame things in a way to show what you're trying to say. But Sapna, this has been a really wonderful interview. I've already learned so much about misinformation, and I'm really thankful that I could have you on the show today. Do you have any other things you want to talk about, or like resources that people could look to if they want to learn more about misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, I think two kind of things to keep in mind. The first is that it's rapidly evolving. Like these bad actors who are putting information out there, they're kind of like crafty. They're updating their techniques as they see how people respond to it in real time. Big data is helping them. AI is helping them. So I think just be continually aware of, you know, there's academic research that's coming out every year that addresses some of these new challenges. And so I would stay and plugged into that. I think a lot of it is they're increasingly trying to make like science research more geared towards the public. So I think definitely look into academic research if you're interested to learn more about it. There's also a lot of great articles just like on reliable, reputable news sites. Also plug for a website called Media Bias Fact Check, which has some interesting graphic design choices, which might make you think it looks like a scam, but it actually is really interesting. And it'll like give you like this methodology where it shows you how they've like rated pretty much every like news site in existence. So super cool. Check it out. And the other thing I think to answer your previous question is just to be like a critical person when engaging with your media. Like don't necessarily just accept everything you see. I'm not saying act as though we're in a post-truth world and that truth doesn't exist, because I think that's sort of what the bad actors are trying to get you to think. But I'm saying make sure that when you're reading, you're like critically engaging with the content, making sure that you like fact check if there's stuff that sounds fishy, and maybe back it up with other sources, like the same story, because I think that there is a lot of bad information out there, and just being critical media users is something that can definitely help us.
Great. Thank you so much. Just one follow-up question to that. What, in your opinion, are some credible news sources, or like sources that you find, from your opinion, to be the most truthful?
So that's really interesting. I actually feel like my approach to consuming media is to like get stuff that I think is explicitly on the left and get stuff that's explicitly on the right, and kind of in my own mind try to figure out where the medium is. So I will look at Fox News and Breitbart, but I will also look at CNN and MSNBC. I think a reputable news source, I mean, the New York Times is great. Like, I do like it. I also like that, you know, there was this op-ed that was recently published that was, it's kind of a leftist paper, and it was definitely an op-ed that was from a person who is expressing a very like conservative, like traditionally like socially conservative point of view. And although I kind of question the decision to publish that in particular, I think it's interesting because they did it, but they also publicized the fact that their own editor, like people within their own staff, were upset about it. Like, they're so transparent. That's what I like. So I love the New York Times, but I also personally, just by virtue of being like a media studies scholar, try to look at stuff on every sort of side of the political spectrum.
That's great. Thanks so much.
And that's all for today. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated. And now on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. And if you haven't already, check out last week's guest, Max Thomas, and his troupe, Preach Improv, on Instagram for their Juneteenth celebration. It's already so amazing. And make sure to tune in next week for our season 1 finale. Bye. Have a great week.